The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. We've been discussing the organisms that we find in the group known as cephalopods, a class of organisms. We've talked about the octopus, we've talked about the chambered nautilus, and we've talked about the squid. As I was saying over what we had discussed last time, I want to go back and make one comment about the chambered nautilus. These organisms, which are shelled, they have a shell, they have a pair of eyes, they have 60 to 70 tentacles as opposed to the usual 8 arms and 2 tentacles of the squid and the octopus. But these organisms also are found, have been found, as much as 400 meters down in the ocean. And one of the mysteries is, how in the world is it possible for that rather thin shell to withstand the pressure of that weight of water on them? And I certainly do not know the answer. There have been some solutions that have been proposed. I don't think there's any that are widely accepted. There is another organism in this group, the cuttlefish, that might be familiar to some of you, in that there is a little white structure in the cuttlefish that historically has been used as a structure that's put in bird cages that allow the birds to sharpen their beaks on it. One unusual characteristic that I have not mentioned that most people who have any knowledge of the group would know about is that they have the capability of producing ink, and often when they are startled, they will simply eject this cloud of ink and use it as a way of hiding their escape. They don't sit there and wait, but they do that, and then they're gone. And it's a very effective way of doing that. If we were going to take longer, there are all kinds of things that we could talk about with these organisms. The squid apparently reproduce, copulate, body to body, as opposed to the octopus, where you have the male octopus that will take little sac-like structures that contain sperm and place them with one of its arms into the reproductive tract of the octopus. Now, you can't mention structures or habits, behaviors of these things that do not raise problems from an evolutionary standpoint. A comment I've had occasion to make more than once, and I will repeat it here, is that these kinds of whatever structures an organism has or whatever their behavior is, they have to work right the first time because the life of the organism depends on these things. And the notion that there can be some kind of a hit or miss, trial and error attempt at creating this kind of thing and try it out on the organism and see if it works, and if it doesn't, you go back and try again, that doesn't work. Because most of these are going to bring about the death of the organism if they do not work properly, either by not allowing reproduction or by simply not allowing the organism to behave in such a way that it can stay alive. And this is the point of our looking at all the variety of organisms, is simply to refute the idea that the best answer to all of the variety of organisms that we see is evolution, the notion that they have descended somehow from common ancestors, which are not available to us at all. Now, there's one other subject I would like to go to before we leave this, and that has to do with the evolution of these organisms. I'm thinking now, evolution, there are 3 subclasses that, as I mentioned to you before, that are found in the cephalopods, the nautiloidea, and in each case there are structures there that would separate, there's a reason for them putting separate classes. They're different from the others. This subclass, of course, would include the chambered nautilus. A second would be the ammonoidea, and this would include the organism of the ammonites. The ammonites were, as far as I'm aware, they are extinct. You find them regularly in the fossil record. We have numbers of different kinds of ammonites in our fossil collection at school. But as far as I am aware, they do not exist at this point. And then the coleoidea, which are the organisms that the subclass that contain octopus, squid, cuttlefish, devilfish, and so on. Now, was there a common ancestor just for these three kinds of organisms from which all of them could have evolved? And the answer to that question simply is no. But I want to pursue that with you a little bit. There is a article that I ran across some time ago. It was written by the same two, Runniger, Bruce Runniger, and John Pojita, in an article that was entitled Molluscan Phylogeny. For those of you that do not know, the term phylogeny simply means evolution. So the article was dealing with Molluscan evolution. Molluscan Phylogeny, the Paleontological Viewpoint. This was published in Science back in 1974. And on page 316, a quote from that article, quote, Stasek theorized that the extant mollusks, that is those that are alive today, are the progeny of three separate lineages that separated before the phylum was well established. Now what they're saying then is that each of these subclasses are descendants of three separate organisms. There was not a single common ancestor for all three of them. And this is a mini version of the monophyletic, polyphyletic business. The monophyleticism, the idea that there was a single organism from which all three subclasses would come, is tremendously problematic. We talked about this at some length earlier. I won't go into it again. But there are also some rather obvious difficulties with the idea, in this case, of three organisms that were ancestral to each, to the three organisms in that are extant today. So you had three ancestors, one of which would have produced the representatives that we find in each of the three subclasses. And this simply postpones the problem for a while. Where did these ancestors come from? And by the way, if they occurred, there ought to be representatives of them in the fossil record. And yet, if you would look at almost any textbook, which invertebrate text or zoology text, and you would see phylogenetic trees, or more commonly today, clades, cladograms or cladographs. And usually you will see at some point diagrams or pictures of the organisms we've talked about, the scaphopoda, the bivalves, the cephalopods, the gastropods, the snails, the monoplacophora, and so on. You will see diagrams or pictures of all of those. But then you will see a series of lines that is going to run back to some presumed ancestor for all of them. So you've got the problem of having an organism that the three types of organisms in cephalopods could have come from, or you can push that back in some way, but it doesn't solve the problem, and it makes it worse because when you do that, there is no basis in the fossil record for these. When you look at these kinds of things, what you're looking at is simply a sketch, a diagram, which is a mental construct depending upon the presupposition of the person who's drawing it. And there would not be agreement among all of these. If you were to look in different texts at the phylogenetic tree or the cladogram for these organisms, you'd find them very different. And as I have observed before, any time you have a disagreement among knowledgeable people, the first conclusion you ought to come to is that these folks really do not know which of these is true. And they really don't. I'm not trying to be unduly nasty or tedious about this, but I think it's important for those of us who are creationists not to be browbeaten or awed over the ability to produce diagrams or drawings or mental constructs in such a way that they seem to give evidence or proof when in fact they really don't do that at all. So, in the mind of the gentleman that we have been talking about, there would not have been a single ancestor for the three, but there would have been three. Now, let me go back to the quote and read it accurately to you. Stasek theorized that the extant mollusks are the progeny of three separate lineages that separated before the phylum was well established. He wrote that no known intermediate forms, fossil or living, bridge the enormous gaps between any two of the three lineages. Now, again, this is an evolutionist speaking. It is not a creationist. But he's saying, no, there was not a separate ancestor for each of the three kinds of organism, chambered nautilus, octopus, squid. Rather, there were three separate lineages that existed prior to the appearance of those organisms that we see in nature today. And then he goes on and makes the comment, there are no known intermediate forms, fossil or living, that bridge the enormous gaps between any two of the three lineages. Now, this is a very honest appraisal of the difficulty. And it simply means you can make your choice about whether the organisms in this class, the three we've been talking about, had a common ancestor or separate ones. But if you push it into the distant past, you still face the difficulty at some point. If the evolutionists were correct, were there, in fact, three different organisms at some point, each of which gave rise to one of these forms, the chambered nautilus, the squid, or the octopus? And then you're faced with, okay, fine, where did they come from? Now, particularly in light of the fact that there are absolutely no fossil forms, no missing links that would solve this difficulty, it is simply not, it's not possible to give an answer to it. Let me go back and read the last sentence and finish the quote. He wrote that no known intermediate forms, fossil or living, bridged the enormous gaps between any two of the three lineages, and therefore treated each as a separate subphylum with the necessity of a separate ancestor of some sort. So as we have looked at these cephalopods, this class, interesting, unique in many respects, different from one another, and for a person who is trying to accommodate their appearance on the basis of evolution, there are simply not just difficult problems in my mind, there simply is not possible to come up with an organism that would be suitable for that.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson at bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.